Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here. I want to thank Pat, my friend, and my very first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous for asking me to speak tonight. I have 8 days more than her, and Pat is part of the reason I have 8 days more than her. it's nice to celebrate a birthday with her every August, and she's part of the class of 75. There's a few of us left. It wasn't a big year for getting sober. I think we meet every 5 years now in a restaurant. We can shove two tables together. So we're a tight little group. And it's nice to be here because this is my home group. You are, I'm a product of you. How do I look? thought I'd be your Valentine. I started to drink when I was 14 years old, and I'll tell you what happened. Orville, okay. What happened was, when I got the Canadian Club down, the legs looked better. My legs looked better sitting on that 57 Chevy than they'd ever looked. The football players standing around me didn't seem quite so intimidating. In fact, I could kind of talk to them and have a few chug-a-lug contests with them. My mind got quiet, and sparks flew. Alcohol did something for me that nothing else had done to that point in my life. And from that point on, I didn't get drunk every night, but it became a priority. And until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out what was my problem, and Alcoholics Anonymous became a priority, my life got worse. My life got worse with all the help I got, all the people I tried to help me, all the things I tried, all the places I went. Everything that would seem to fix it momentarily, it didn't get better. It just got worse. And alcoholism is a progressive disease, and it progressed in every area of my life, so that when I got here, 2 weeks into my 26th year of my life, 170-some pounds, broken jaw, wired-up face, looking like a raccoon, bleach-stained T-shirts, broken shoes, falling out of my blue jeans, and you were happy to have me, so you were a sick bunch. You're glad I was here. That's where it took me. And I'll tell you, that's not what I put on my resume in high school that I wanted to be when I grew up. That's not what I thought was my problem in life. It was it was what you had done to me. It was them. It was, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you talked about they, I knew that you knew. You know, you were reading my mail. You were talking about some things I had always known. I don't know what I am. I guess I'm a dysfunctional adult of a normal functional family. You know, they are all normal. They are still all normal. They never understood me, and I never understood them. And when I drank, though, I could perform. I could show up. I could be the best. And it gave me that feeling of omnipotence. And as my life went on, in the late 60s, when I went to college, there was a lot of anger, a lot of confusion. So I quit going to college, and I got involved with the confusion and the anger because that's where I was. I was into a lot of combining the drugs with the alcohol, a lot of LSD, and I thought my mind would expand, and what happened was my mind reduced, you know, and my pain expanded, and it had the opposite effect on me, and I thought I had found truth, and I thought truth was in New York, and I tried New York for a while, and I started to run from myself. I didn't know that I was running. The grass was always greener. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a guy named Norm told me the reason the grass was greener was because the other guy took care of his lawn. Simple, you know? There's a lot of truths here, and a lot of them are very simple. But college just didn't do it because I wanted to be involved in something. I had this big desire to be a part of that peace movement, you know, but I had the peace sign in one hand and the one finger in the other, and I couldn't quite get it all together, and I was angry, and I was mad at God, and I was mad at my father. I was so mad at my father, and I ended up in Colorado, and I thought I met Bob Dylan and came to California, and I just was on a roll. I just ended up at a commune, and I turned 21 out in California. The Krishnas wanted me because they saw that hole in my psyche. Everybody always saw that hole in my psyche, and they were always wanting to try to fix me. The Scientologists would always follow me around. And And I liked what all of these people had to say. The Pentecostal Holy Rollers tried to save me, and the Jesus Freaks in Laguna wanted to baptize me. And once they talked about forever, I was gone. You know, if I couldn't put it in my knapsack, I didn't want to own it, and that was it. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the biggest hooks for me was it's a day at a time. I kept waiting for that forever. Where's the other shoe going to drop? And they said, uh-uh, today. Just today, kid. I liked that. And I ended up 21 years old, moving to an organic farm in northern Wisconsin because I thought that was going to fix it. They thought if they made me organic, I'd be better. And they took away my alcohol. They took away my cigarettes. They gave me organic pot. They gave me a Del Davis and Neil Gibbons and Mother Earth News. And we would drive into this co-op and buy this bulk food, and I would look in the back of the pickup and know I'm not going to be around to eat all this food. I mean, it just seemed like a lot of work and forever, but they took out my gallbladder and they asked me if I abuse drugs or alcohol, and I have a couple of drinks a week maybe of this little organic dandelion wine. And I was very sick with pancreatitis, and I started to get better. And I remember, though, at one point that winter, looking at the person that I was living with and looking at how much he was irritating me that night. He was playing the banjo, and he never did learn to play the banjo. And that night, the snow was falling, and the cat was nervous, you know, and I was nervous, and the dog was nervous, and Pete Seeger just got to me, you know. It just wasn't working tonight. And I went and got 2 big gallons of wine, and I came back, and I got really drunk. And the man that I was living with looked at me. He woke up and came out and looked at me and gave me that look that I had seen, and that look of hurt and confusion and disgust, and what's wrong with you, and why do you act like this, and if you just wouldn't drink, maybe you'd be okay. And my head said that night, you know, alcohol is more fun than you, Phil. And I made a decision. And that's what I did from 21 to 26 when I got here. I gave pieces of myself. I would sit down at a bar somewhere and Sulphur, Louisiana. I put down a piece of my soul just so Jose Cuervo would work one more night. Just let it work one more night. And I would do that night after night after night until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So by the time I got here, there wasn't much of me left. And I didn't try to control and enjoy my drinking. I joined a carnival, is what I did. And that carnival took me down south, and that carnival, I thought it was going to be my answer to, you know, that's where you find him. I found him. So if you're looking, girls, try the carnival. They're real ambitious, and they have a lot of names. But I ended up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, thrown in jail for drugs, and I had no idea how I had ended up in this situation. And when I got out and went to New Orleans, I found home in the French Quarter. I just took like a duck to water. I just found home. And I drank fast and hard and heavy, and I combined it with everything I always did, which was usually crystal methadrine and amyl nitrate. But I danced off too many of these pianos to be prolific at this dancing on Bourbon Street number. So I ended up being a bartender, and that's what I did until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I worked some nice places, and then I got fired for being drunk on the job, and I started to work more local places. And the local places were my type of bar, because if you walked in, I'd take good care of you, because I was going to go in your bar on your shift later, and you would take good care of me. And you know, I worked at places, Funky Butts and the Bastille, and some very local type of joints that you could stay in there 2 days and not know how many days had passed, you know. I had some friends down there, and when we would all black out and lose a day, we'd think that was something to celebrate. I had been drinking and blackouts for years. As my drinking progressed, I didn't take care of myself in blackouts. I didn't care where I ended up. I didn't know whose blood it was on me, and nor did I care when I would come to between the car and the curb and wonder how I had gotten there, or if I'm coming or going out of my door, I'm half in and I'm half out. And my parents came to visit me at this last point in my life, and they saw me living above a biker bar, living in filth, living with this my carnival friend. And we had a 2-year black eye knife fight relationship, true love, never a dull moment. And my mother had a tear in her eye, and my father couldn't look at me. We hadn't spoken really in years, and I know they wanted to take me home. And I know that if I would have gone home with them, I knew then it wouldn't change. And I didn't know it was alcoholism, and they didn't know it was alcoholism. I felt so bad. I always just thought I was a bad person, and I didn't know what I had done in my past lives, but this is what was happening to me, and I cared less and less about myself. And I had about another year and a half of drinking after that. My drinking took me back to California a number of times, and I kept ending up in a bar called Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood, and that's where I first saw the Big Book, was in that bar. And a girl named Chris had it with her friend, and they were calling a taxi to take them to an A&A meeting because they were too drunk to drive. So we cleared them out the door with our triples, and out they went. And little did I know that on my next trip back to California, when I was on my way to Hawaii, I'm still here and I haven't made Hawaii yet, but I was on the run again. I had become unemployable. My last job was on Lower Decatur Street in the French Quarter, which isn't the top tourist stop. It's where the bars smell. It's where I smelled. I was 170 pounds to have a dance with for a dollar and buy me a drink, and I got fired from that job for having a bad attitude. So they didn't want me back either when I begged for that job back. I was unemployable. I couldn't get a job out here. Someone hired me for about 4 hours as a cocktail waitress. I couldn't remember where the bar was when I turned around. My mind was starting to go. But I could find my seat at Barney's Beanery. I could always do that. And July 27th, 1975, I got on the back of a couple of Harleys because I like to do that. And they invited me only because it was windy that night going through the desert to go to Palm Springs, and I was 170-some pounds to put on that back tire. So they called me out. They put the fat one on the back, and let's go. And that's, you know, and when they had the 20 questions in Alcoholics Anonymous, I said no to the lower companions. You know, I don't hang around lower companions. I was it. But I wasn't very, I didn't have that level of honesty going then. So they took me to a nightclub, and they dropped me off. And by the time... And they went their way. And by the time that evening was over, I ended up with, I ended up at 6:30 in that morning outside of Palm Springs at the bottom of a cliff, face down. I didn't have any clothes on. I had just been raped and beaten up that night. I had a broken jaw in three places. My nose was broken. I was bleeding profusely from my face. I was very hurt and beaten up. And I was laying face down in that sand. And, you know, I remember at some point in that night just, I'm not even going to scream anymore. Who cares? Who cares? I knew you didn't, and I knew I didn't. But something happened that morning. Something happened that woke me up, and something happened that said, get up, I want to live. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know how you got here tonight to sit in the seat and have the gift of sobriety given to you that not everybody gets. But I know that we were plucked somewhere from that abyss. We were plucked somewhere from the disease of alcoholism, plopped down into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and given a chance to pick up the tools to have a life and to have a life of some divine grace and some fun. But I didn't know that laying face down in the sand. All I knew was that I got up. All I knew was that something inside of me, the survival in me just kicked up. You know, something said get up, and I did get up, and I found somebody's condominium and I passed out by their pool. A foot away, you'd have another speaker, seconds and inches. When Norm Alpe used to talk about that, seconds and inches, I used to just wake up. I knew what he meant. You know, just the times you drive home with just one eye, or how did I get home, or I missed that coffee table by an inch when I passed out, you know. Seconds and inches that we're sitting in here. And I was a victim. I was a victim. The Palm Springs police thought I was a victim. All the doctors thought I was a victim. The newspapers thought I was a victim. And I had always wanted that documented because I had been a victim in those bars for years. I had been a victim and living in my life, trapped inside of me for years. It's your fault. It's nothing to do with me. Self-pity. It's just a hideous thing. And my alcoholism would drown that, and it would take care of it for most of the time. When I drank that Jose Cuervo Gold, it would put out that fire most times until it stopped working. But I ended up in the hospital, and an interesting bunch of events happened that nobody sent me a plane ticket, nobody wanted to go start over again in Wisconsin. You know, there was just nobody. My parents didn't send me anything, and I was left alone there. And when I got out, a guy I had met at Barney's who felt sorry for me said I could come live with him, and I lived above a liquor store on the corner of Overland and Palms. And I was on a liquid diet because I had these wires, and he would buy me red wine because it was the cheapest thing, and I'd stick a straw on the top of the red wine and stick a straw through where the tooth had been through the wires, and I'd suck on this red wine, and it was August, and it was hot, and it was like drinking Kool-Aid. There was no more warmth, there was no more magic, there was no more relief, there was no more, oh, it's going to be okay feeling anymore. And when he told me I had to leave that day, which was August 20th, I didn't know that you know, I was going to turn right or turn left. And by divine grace, I turned right. You know, by divine grace, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, not knowing that that was my problem. I called my mother because he told me I had to leave. And I always called my mom when the chips were down. And my mother said a sentence to me that if it would have been different, you would have another speaker tonight. She says, "Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army?" And Mom always sent me something from her grocery money so that my father didn't know. But she always sent me something, and this time she didn't. And for some reason, that girl I had met in Barney, her number was there, Chris. And I can't call Chris on my birthday every year and thank her for bringing me here, because she died of the disease of alcoholism about 5 years ago. And but she got me here. She gave me a number of somebody named Suzanne. Suzanne went right to work on me. She was a member of this group. She sent two of her newcomers over, and they picked me up and threw me in the back of a Volkswagen. I had no idea where I was going. Absolutely no idea. I just knew it was some other place or the Salvation Army, and I came to this some other place, which happened to be Alcoholics Anonymous. See, Chris spotted my disease because she was an alcoholic, and Chris said, "These people can help you." And I believed her. I don't know why. And I came here, and it was an Echo Park meeting Wednesday night. We used to meet at Echo Park. The big meeting was on Tuesday at Ohio Street, and the Wednesday night meeting was smaller, and John D. was at the door with a tie on, and he was kind to me. I remember him being very kind to me, and they sat me up front, and they raised my hand, and I had a lot of attention, and I didn't understand. They gave me a big book, and some old man gave me the 20 questions, and I only took them because he looked like my grandfather, and I thought I'd be nice to him. And I passed with 17 and made his night. You know, he was so happy. I had no idea that I was going to change my whole life by sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I had no idea that I was even coming here for a couple of weeks. But I fell into the center of the Pacific group, where the old-timers were teaching their babies how to work with newcomers, and they were sending them all my way. And I later found out they were hoping I'd make it, but they were also hoping they didn't have to get too involved. So they were sending over their new babies with a year and 2 years. And I slept on their floors for a week at a time, various women's floors around here. And I withdrew in that sleeping bag that somebody had loaned me. They gave me a big book, and I had to read 3 pages a night, and it would put me to sleep. And I would sleep, get up, come to a meeting. Sleep, get up, and come to a meeting. And that's all I did. I couldn't eat. I couldn't eat the cookies. I was all wired up the first 3 months I was here. I couldn't talk. I had to learn to listen. You know, it was a wonderful blessing in disguise. And my life slowly started because I started to hear, maybe a couple of weeks into it, I started to hear some identification. People were talking about feelings that I hadn't ever expressed out loud, that I knew they must knew, you know, they must know. And somebody was talking about that they always waited for the spaceship to land, you know, and say that they could come home now. And that's how I always felt, was that, you know, where is the mothership? I used to search the skies for the mothership. And Pat, your secretary, came in 8 days after me and took away all the old-timer attention, so she was my first resentment. Her husband was dying of cancer, and I thought that was, I guess, more to be cared for than this. I kept saying I had to go back to New Orleans and get my clothes, and they'd laugh at me and tell me to read the big book and get a sponsor, and so I got a sponsor because I didn't want them to ask me anymore if I had a sponsor, so I got a sponsor, and she moved me up to her couch, and it was a spiritual awakening. Your life gets better when you get a sponsor. And it made sense to me, and it was real slow in the beginning. And somebody asked me if I wanted to ride to tomorrow night's meeting, and I was very confused. I didn't know I could make plans, and I was spinning through the wires in my face, saying, I don't know, it's a day at a time, you know. I was just that way, and an old-timer named Chuck came over and showed me his calendar and showed me that you can make plans. And he asked me how I was right now, And I am like the newcomer with the Rolodex brain, and you have to spin it for a while. And then when it lands on a card, and all my cards said fine, I was so creative, they all said fine. Yeah. He said, "Well, that's what we're talking about. Emotionally, is all you have to handle is today. But you can get a ride to tomorrow night's meeting." And he explained it to me. And And it made sense. And people told me I looked tired and I should take off my pack and stay with them a while. And I thought, God, they're so smart. How do they know I'm tired? I really am tired. And people seem to have some sort of wisdom around here that I didn't know, that they had walked through what I had walked through. They had come in and raised their hand for 30 days and they knew how I felt. And I was feeling compassion. And I hadn't felt that in so long. And that's a feeling that when it comes up now in sobriety, I love that feeling. That feeling of compassion for another human being, because I thought that was dead within me. I got a $24 a week room. I got a job as a waitress. I had a sponsor that was mean and wouldn't let me stay home and have my brain tumor and made me go to work. And I used to call Janet at 6 in the morning, and I didn't realize I was waking her up. You know, I'm too self-obsessed. I told her I had the brain tumor. I can't go to work. And she'd say, well, you go to work, and if you die at work, you'll get an AA funeral. But if you die at home in bed, no funeral. And she'd hang up on me. She'd make me mad. So I'd show up at work and do everything she said so I could come home at 5 o'clock and call her and tell her she was wrong. I still had a bad day. But motives don't count, and I went out there and I do what she'd say, and I always have a better day when I can turn my judgment over to a sponsor's, because between me and my sponsor is air. Between me and me is those people that live up there, and they're not always on my side, those people. And a lot of times I have to leave my mind in the car and just suit up and show up. That's what I have to do. And my life got better, and I became involved with another newcomer. And I, you know, to me, he had 6 months more than me. He was an old timer, and I found out that, you know, he did coffee, so I'd make cookies. And I liked having commitments. I liked the power of having the cookie commitment, because if you were an old timer and you were nice to me, you got your cookies that week. And if you weren't nice to me, I wouldn't buy your cookies. I would spend 2 hours in the grocery store looking at all the cookies. But my life got better. I got a better job. I got married at 2 years of sobriety. I didn't know that I was going to do that. My father and my mother came out to see me. My life had gotten better in those 2 years because I had done my inventory. Something I wasn't going to do was do my inventory. At 11 months of sobriety, I remember calling my sponsor from the airport, and I told her that I am going to go have my slip now because I'm almost a year sober and I better hurry up and have it, because everybody talks about how much their slip has helped them. And she said, fine, you can go have your slip, but you'll be like my friend Stella, who burned up in a bed. And I thought, well, I don't want to burn up in a bed. And she made me mad again. So I sat there at the airport and I started to write my inventory. And I don't know what it was, if it was the jet fuel or the people coming and going, but I write every inventory at the airport. It still works for me today. And I did my fifth step with her, and I took my first year cake, and I felt something happen. I felt like I deserved this cake. See, I come from the place of absolutely no self-esteem. I am a real good, I can fake it, I can be a phony, and I can put it on. But inside I was empty and dead. And by working the steps, I started to get a little bit, because that inventory was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. And when I actually finished it and did my fifth step, it made me feel good about myself. And I was the type of person in my first year, if I went into your store, I'd buy something because I took up your air. If I went to a gas station, I'd tip you because you did my windows. That was back in the days of full serve. I had absolutely no self-worth. I would explain to you if you gave me a compliment. They told me to shut up and just say thank you. My father was amazed at my life out here. Things were still tense between us, and they got a little better after I was 5 years sober and I started to make financial amends to him. I have a sponsor named Ginny who asked me how it was with my dad, and she said, do you owe him any money? And I said, oh yeah, well, he doesn't need it. And she said, do you owe him any money? And I said, yeah, I guess I do. There were, you know, the car I took and the lawyer he paid for and all those bounce checks. And she said, well, why don't you call him up and ask him? And so I said, okay, but he's going to, you know, he's not going to care. Just call him up. And I called him up, and he had that figure on the top of his head like he had been waiting 5 years for my phone call. He has the big book. He's read the steps. He was waiting. I called her back. I said, he told me it's this much, it's too much. And she said, I don't care. What can you afford? And so we talked about that, and she said, okay, call him back and ask him if it's okay. And a couple days later, I did that, and he didn't say, I've changed my mind. He said, that's fine. And I called her back and I said, okay. She said, make out your envelopes and send it on the first every month. You know, no matter what, you send that money. And I said, okay. And she said, oh, yeah, by the way, put a note about your life and how you're doing and what's happening. And just kind of let them get to know you a little bit. And I said, God, they ask for so much, these sponsors. I mean, they want you to grow, I guess. You know, they push. So I started doing that, and I did that for a number of years. I kept track of the payments I was making. I never keep track of the payments. I kept track of the payments I was making to him, and I called her one day, and I said, I think I've overpaid him. And she said, I don't care. Send it. He's putting it into a trust fund. You can buy your Jaguar. So I sent it happily that month, maybe even early that month, you know, and he didn't know. He has no idea my motives behind any of this. He just gets the end result of Alcoholics Anonymous. So after I'd been doing this about 3 years, he called me up one holiday, and he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon, you don't have to send me any more checks. And then he added, don't stop sending me your notes. And it was like the baggage was cut loose. It was just like the baggage was cut loose. I was able to walk free with my father. I was able to be his little girl. I was able to be his friend. As our life has gotten closer through the years, I'm amazed at what a nice man he is and how much I'm like him. Don't tell him I said that. At 10 years of sobriety, I had a little baby boy, and I never thought I would do that. At 9 years, I had Wesley, and I was secretary of this meeting. I had to stand sideways to talk into the mic. He was a good little Alla babe. He waited until my term was over to be born. And on June 23rd, 1984, I gave birth to him, and it was... He had all his fingers and all his toes, and it was another glorious day to be grateful. And he's 5 years old now, and asked to leave one kindergarten, and now he's in another. But the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But he responds to love. He responds to program. He responds to all of you here. All of you here have been such a part of him growing up. At 10 years, my life fell apart. I'll tell you, I had no defects of character until I think I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and I thought they were all rubbing off me by sitting next to you in Ohio Street, you know, and giving me the ideas from the podium. I had never thought of that stuff before. And what happened at 3 and 4 years was I had to start working on me, and at 10 years of sobriety, I also had to start working on me because my marriage of 8 years fell apart, I'll tell you, we can do what I can't do, and I had forgotten that. And many of you just rally rounded me. You know, you wouldn't let me sit at home and pull the covers. You made me get out there, and you made me keep taking commitments, and you made me show up. And one night my sponsor happened to be at a Saturday night meeting, and my sponsor was Clancy. He became my sponsor at about 9 years of sobriety because I needed to get another sponsor. My other sponsor had lost her time, and... I wanted what he had because he's out there in the trenches walking ahead of me having a good time and living his life and not losing the excitement of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so much fun to feel that excitement. When I was 7 years sober, I finally felt it from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, like a complete human being, you know, full of this fellowship and full of spirit. And I was so glad I finally had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Not because I sat at home and thought about it, but by showing up and suiting up. So Clancy was my sponsor, and I had a particularly bad night, and he caught my eye, and he caught my shoulder, and he grabbed me, and he looked me in the eyes, and he said, Sharon, walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others. And I heard him, and I started working on me again. I'm a real good judger. I'm a real good victim. I finally had to hang up the black. I went to visit Sheila one day. I sponsor Sheila. She's a nun and a principal, and I have felt very comfortable with the Catholic Church again. I have made my peace there, and I was sitting there waiting for her one day, and I felt the peace of healing happen once again after walking through a hallway that I didn't even know would end, you know. I used to think life was one door closing, another opening, you know, instant results. That's the way Jose Cuervo Gold did, you know. It just was instant results, and that's the way I liked life. Instant change, instant results, And now I go for long-term comfort around here. And sometimes I got to walk through that hallway. One door closed and the other one won't quite open yet. And I got to grow up a little bit in that hallway. And I got to meet other people in there. And I got to walk into a meeting where see where I can be of service and where I can give instead of where I can take. Because I want to be a part of the excitement of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous today. My life started to change from that point on. I have a terrific job that I went out and got because the people here walked me through that. They told me I was worth something, and I believed their judgment more than I believed my judgment. And today I feel like I am worth something. today I have a sense of peace within me that nothing is ever given. Nothing that I ever took, ingested, has ever given that to me, the sense of peace I have that I can wake up with and fall asleep with. And when I hit my knees at night and I say thank you, I have a whole list of things to be grateful for. I don't pop out of bed in the morning and be spiritual and wonderful. I still have a hard time sometimes with that. My first higher power around here was Beacon's moving van. I did that just to piss Janet off, too. She told me to get something as long as it wasn't me, and Beacon's moving van drove by, so I told her that was my new higher power, and she said, fine, as long as it's not you. And today when I'm uptight and I'm on the freeway and I do what Judy's doing, I talk to the people in the cars next to me, and I'll be trying to cut off that little old lady who's seemingly having a good morning. Beacon's moving van will drive by and just remind me of, you know, it's going to be okay. It still works for me today. My God is a loving God that cares about me and cares about you. And I don't always like all of you all the time. You don't like me all of the time. But I know that I love you because I wish you well. I wish you the tools of this program, if you're new, to sit here and sit on your hands, you know, and stay here long enough until something starts to make some sense. Don't drink and use between meetings. I heard that. And because I heard that on August 20th, 1975, I've got almost 14 and a half years of growth here, of walking with you, of being a member of this group where we do a lot of things together. I got to go back to New Orleans and make amends at the International Convention and show all of you my old haunts. And as a result of that, one of the girls that I used to hang with is sober 5 years, and I sponsor her. And another one, Denny, is sober, and she's sober 5 years, and she's a prosecutor for the city of New Orleans now. You don't know where the example can lead. And if I can just get up in the morning and be grateful for what I have and go out in the world and see where I can give instead of take, maybe I can make this world a more positive place, a world I still don't understand. But I have my tools, I have my sponsor, I have my God. I know when to clean house, and I have you to remind me. I have you to remind me how grateful and lucky we are here. You took a girl, not even a girl, a thing, with a broken jaw, broken spirit, smelling, reeking of alcohol, and dirty. And you were proud of me. And you gave me those tools, and you said, okay, kid, stick around, you look tired. Here's the tools. We'll teach you how to use them, but you got to use them. And you can have a life. Stay with us. So if you're new, stay with us. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Tim Kruger, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight and glad to be sober. And would like to thank Pat for asking me to share tonight. I used to drink, you know, and I drank because I was uncomfortable. And from the time I can remember, I always felt uncomfortable inside. And I was never really quite sure why, and I really don't think it had anything to do with anything other than who I was. And when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I was home alone one night, and I decided that it would be a good idea to get drunk. And that's what I did. You know, I poured a big 16-ounce tumbler of whiskey and put in some fake lemon juice on top, make it taste okay, and just drank it down, boom. And I remember thinking, you know, nothing really special happened at that moment, so I drank another one. And a little less lemon juice that time. And I remember walking around the kitchen. I was just kind of staggering around. I thought, God, this is great. This is fun. And I just kind of blacked out from that moment. I don't remember anything else about that night. I don't remember getting up in the morning feeling sick or anything, but you know, something happened for me that night. It wasn't a conscious thing. It wasn't, you know, I didn't all of a sudden wake up the next day and think, gosh, this alcohol is wonderful. I don't feel uncomfortable. You know, it was just sort of there. It was sort of a gradual process. Every time I drank after that, it sort of dawned on me more and more that this was kind of working for me. That when I drank, I didn't have those feelings of unease. And I felt like I could be a part of something. You know, I'd hang around with the guys. You know, I always hung around with the bad guys. And when I drank, I felt comfortable hanging around them. I really felt like I was part of something. And, you know, as my life progressed and I got older and older, you know, it seemed that year by year I started to drink more and more. And, you know, it wasn't, I don't know, at that time it just seemed like, you know, something, you know, kind of coming of age type of thing. It didn't appear to be a problem. But looking back on it now, I can tell that I had already started a series of small excuses to myself when I drank. You know, I always seemed to have a little reason in the back of my head for drinking. You know, I didn't just drink, but there was a reason to drink. And as my life progressed, I became more and more dependent on alcohol, to the point where, you know, I drank every single day for years. I mean, just from the time I woke up in the morning to the time I went to bed. And, you know, it wasn't, I mean, it was a complete and total obsession with alcohol. And when you do that, your life tends to fall apart on you. And mine fell apart on me. You know, I always thought of myself as sort of this freewheeling, swashbuckling, adventurous kind of guy, you know, and really what I was irresponsible and immature. And, you know, because I didn't care about anybody or anything. You know, I didn't pay my bills. You know, I paid them when it was convenient to pay them. You know, I'd just throw them away. You know, I didn't even look at it. I just throw them away. And they don't like that when you do that. You know, and I would just do things like one time my car got a flat tire and I just parked it for a year and a half. You know, it was just, I couldn't deal with it. It was a little bit too much for me. You know, I just, you know, and I was just a complete and utter slob. You know, there's always bottles of booze all over the room, you know, empty ones, of course, you know, everywhere. And clothes, I had this, the last place I lived, I had this huge king-size bed in there. It took up about 85% of the room, and I kind of fill up the crevices around with dirty clothes and stuff. And when it got so bad that not even I could stand it, you know, my solution was to go sleep in the living room. So that'll give you some idea of the type of person I was. But what happened was I got, from that obsession, you know, I reached a point of complete desperation. I mean, I can't imagine being more desperate. I had nothing. I weighed 165 pounds. I shook so bad I couldn't, you know, I couldn't put a key in a lock. You know, misery isn't even the word for it. You know, I mean, there was nothing in my life but alcohol. I mean, that's what I live for. It's absolutely what I live for. And I got a break. You know, my liver stopped working. And if it, I don't say it to be funny, it's true, because I'm the kind of alcoholic that I would have died drinking before admitting that I was an alcoholic. But because this happened, I mean, when your liver stops, you know, stops functioning normally, you're in bad shape, and it laid me up. And I came to the realization through what I believe was a spiritual experience that I was an alcoholic. And from that time on, I became involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has changed my life dramatically. It's been a slow change. I remember when I was in a place up in Northern California for 28 days, and when I got out of there, a friend of mine decided to throw me a welcome home party, and so I went there. I didn't know anybody in Southern California, so he invited all his friends, and you know, they were all these people I didn't know drinking and snorting cocaine and everything else. You know, it was some welcome party. My way to deal with that was I decided to take some non-prescription allergy pills to get over the discomfort. And so because of that, you know, I was around here for a while, and I hadn't changed my sobriety date. And I changed my sobriety date because of that, only because of the discomfort involved with it. I mean, I also, you know, when I was new, my mind just didn't function properly. I remember one night I asked Clancy if he would sponsor me, and he said, "Yeah, I'll help you, kid." And I didn't realize that that was a yes. It, you know, it was a little too complicated for me. He didn't say yes. So I went and got another sponsor. You know, I didn't know that's what that meant. So, you know, that kind of, it took me a while for the cobwebs to clear. And they have cleared. You know, by taking the actions that have been laid out for me in this program, my life has changed dramatically. It's it bears no resemblance to the life I've known before. I mean, I don't look the same. I don't act the same. And I certainly don't live the same. And it's all a result of this program and doing my best to try and work these 12 steps every day, which is difficult. I mean, the steps aren't something that come naturally to me. You know, when somebody ticks me off, I mean, my first notion is not to go work a step. You know, it's to go knock them out. And it's just, you know, so it's work for me. It's work to do it. But the degree to which I've been willing to work the steps, or at least willing to try to work them, I believe, is the degree to which I've been able to have some recovery in this program. You know, I've gotten married since I've been here. I've done things here that I never thought I could do. I've always been paralyzed by fear, whether it's fear of something, a tremendous thing in my life, or just those little nitpicky fears that you run into every day. And I was never willing to face them and try and overcome them. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the gift to have the courage to do those things. You know, I got married on this program. I have just a great marriage. I have a good job. My job really amazes me. You know, because of my past history, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that I can't get a credit card with a, you know, more than a $500 limit on it. And I have a job where I'm responsible for lending out hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, you figure it out. I mean, it just doesn't, it's amazing. You know, I love my life today. I like getting up in the morning. I had an experience a couple weeks ago. I couldn't believe it. It'll make you sick. You know, I mean, I was laying in bed at night, and I was so excited about my life, I couldn't go to sleep. You know, and I mean, that's amazing. It used to be I couldn't go to, you know, I mean, and it's true. I mean, I couldn't go to sleep because, you know, I was so obsessed with alcohol that and, you know, snorting drugs and everything else that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't get to sleep. And here I was, you know, I was so pleased with my life that I couldn't get to sleep. And it, as I say, it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the help I've received from this group, and thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Our next 10-minute speaker will be Judy R.
Hi, my name is Judy Ross. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I also want to thank Pat for asking me to share tonight. I volunteered to read the 12 traditions, but she said no. Want to wish Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Aren't I sweet? Everybody's somebody's sweetheart somewhere. You may not know who that person is yet, but I also drank alcohol, and I guess I drank alcoholically from about the time I was around 17 until the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, which was 16 years later. I did not have a whole lot of fun during my drinking. I did not party. Most of that time I was married for the year or so before. Well, I got married when I was 19, and we separated about a year and a half or so before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And during the last two or three years that I drank, I drank a lot, and I did a lot of things in blackouts. I drank in blackouts. I went to parties in blackouts. I went to weddings in blackouts. I cleaned my house in blackouts. I drove in blackouts. And I made a lot of friends in blackouts. And I was raised in the Jewish religion, and I had always believed in a God. I had always believed in a kind and loving God. My family loved me very, very much. They took very good care of me. My older brothers and sisters loved me and also took care of me. I have some very fond memories of my childhood. I do not blame my family or my environment or the fact that I only had one real honest to God Pendleton skirt, as you know, for my alcoholism. I believe I was born alcoholic, and when it came time to drink, it just moved it all right along. See, mostly I think that through my high school years I was a reasonably normal person, and that I had a fairly normal and active life in high school. I did well in school, and I had some friends, and I was involved in music and some Jewish youth group activities. I was even in 4-H, for God's sakes, you know. And